Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. It is Sunday, November 11th, 2007. Now for a summary of news highlights. Regarding Bush's peace conference dog and pony show, as we mentioned in last Sunday's broadcast, Israeli Prime Minister Olmert wants to reach an agreement with the Palestinian Authority before President Bush leaves office. Because, as one of his associates quoted him as saying, we'll never have a more comfortable administration, and the next administration will not be committed to the same principles. The principles to which Olmert refers are 1. Support for Israel's retention of major settlement blocks in the West Bank, and 2. The dismantling of so-called terrorist organizations, that is to say, dismantling all groups of Palestinian occupation resistance fighters. In a speech the same day, November 4th, at Israel's prestigious Saban Forum, commemorating the assassination of former Prime Minister Rabin, Olmert declared his commitment to President Bush's vision of two countries for two peoples, a Jewish state for the Jewish people, a Palestinian state for the Palestinian people. Both are fundamental conditions, basic positions, obvious understandings which cannot be denied, he declared. All the basic questions, all the substantive problems, all the historic questions which are pertinent to the disagreement between us and the Palestinians are on the agenda. We will avoid none of them. We will not run from discussing any of them. End of quote. However, he went on to say that, quote, Annapolis will not be a place for negotiations, but will certainly be a starting point, unquote. So what do we have here after we pierce the fog of political language, which George Orwell so aptly described as designed to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind? What we have are basically 3 Israeli preconditions for the conference. Number 1, the Palestinian right of return is off the table. Number 2, all Palestinian resistance to Israel's occupation must be eliminated. And last, but certainly not least, number 3, there will be no negotiations on core issues at the conference. We can talk about it until we're blue in the face, but we will not be seriously discussing how to resolve these issues. So the so-called peace conference is pure wind. We will have more delays in negotiation, more time for obscene military attacks against Palestinian population centers to terrorize Palestinians out of their ancestral homes, more oppression, more killings, more deaths by starvation, disease, and denial of medical care, more abductions in the middle of the night, more prison torture, more land confiscation, all under the pretext of Israeli security, and with a wink and nod of the world community's stunning conspiratorial silence. What lies at the core of this savagery is the world's devastatingly cruel refusal to acknowledge the common humanity of Palestinians, a humanity equal in all respects to the humanity of Israelis, Americans, and Europeans. Rachel Corrie, the 23-year-old American activist whose young life was deliberately snuffed out by an Israeli military bulldozer, cried out to the world's conscience to stop this carnage. This, she cried out, has got to stop. When she was only 10, Rachel said during a school assignment, we have got to understand that people in third world countries think and care and smile and cry just like us. We have got to understand that they dream our dreams and we dream theirs. We have got to understand that they are us, we are them. When, we ask, will the world wake up to what Rachel understood at age 10? According to an old adage, if you control the emotions of a people, you can control their actions. War, we are told, is 1/4 battlefield and 3/4 public relations. So we turn now to the topic of public relations and the exploitation of the most destructive of human emotions, fear, more specifically, Jewish fear. Let it be said here and now that no one who is not a Jew can presume to plumb the depths of Jewish fear, a fear born out of centuries of persecution and oppression in Europe. For more than a century, that fear has been cynically manipulated by Zionist leaders and by those who later rose to the leadership of Israel up to our times, to further the Zionist agenda of conquering Palestine and expelling its indigenous population. In her book, Israel-Palestine, How to End the War of 1948, the late well-known Israeli historian Tanya Reinhardt quotes Ariel Sharon as saying that Israel's current war is, quote, the second half of 1948, unquote. It is thus not a war on terror, as Israel's and America's massive public relations machines would have us believe. It is simply a war for expulsion, in the words of one of Israel's most celebrated leaders. The flames of fear have been fanned throughout Israel's history from its earliest days. Most recently, we heard that during the war in Lebanon last year, when Israelis uniformly avowed that Israel was never in greater danger, we have no choice. No choice but to kill or be killed. We heard it earlier in 1967, only to be told years later by Israeli government and military figures that the government at that time was never in fear of being overrun, and that the fear was manufactured solely for the purpose of arousing public support for that brief war. We hear it from the official mainstream Jewish organizations in the diasporas, most notably in the United States, when they rush to condemn any talk, essay, conference, or demonstration that may be critical of Israel, with cries loaded with heavily coded words like, Israel is being singled out, re-injecting into public consciousness the experiences of pogroms and ghettos in Russia and Poland, or stand up for Israel, with a subliminal message of support Israel or it will perish, and inevitably with the awful hammer of anti-Semitism. No one denies that anti-Semitism exists. It does exist. But the so-called new anti-Semitism is largely and overwhelmingly the result of Israel's savagery in the Palestinian occupied territories. When people are afraid, they can be made to do very nasty things. Israel's finest young men and women who served in the military and from whose ranks Israel's next generation of leaders will emerge are now experiencing serious psychological trauma, as the gravity of what they have done under orders gradually seeps in. Raised in the highest traditions of Judaic teachings of justice, compassion, and high moral ethics, they have been forced under orders from their leadership to commit atrocious acts of unspeakable injustice and betray everything they were brought up to believe makes a Jew a Jew. These scarred young men and women are now seeking treatment and are roaming the world trying to come to terms with the memories that will haunt them for the rest of their lives. All the casualties on the Palestinian side and on the Israeli side as well are directly attributable to the Zionist blueprint of conquest and empire building. Zionism as a plea for a homeland where Jews can be safe from persecution deserves the mantle of moral imperative. But Zionism, as Israel has practiced it before it became a state, and ever since it became a state, the brand of Zionism which calls for conquest and the annihilation or deconstruction of all neighboring nations along the way, is a criminal enterprise which must be fought with every fiber of our being. When Israel's leadership, which purports to speak in the name of Jews everywhere, deliberately prevents their people from healing from their historical wounds, when they keep alive the wounds of the past and deliberately claw into them to further their own ambitions, they commit a heinous crime against their own people and should be made accountable for that crime. The subject of fear is one about which our featured guest has written extensively, and he should know. Dr. Hayo Meir is a Holocaust survivor of Auschwitz, who lives today in the Netherlands, where he works as a publicist and essayist. Following the war, Dr. Meir studied theoretical physics and in 1950 joined the Philips Research Laboratories in Eindhoven, first as a researcher in solid-state physics, then in various managerial functions. In 1956, he received a PhD in physics, and from 1974 to 1984, he held the position of managing director of that lab. And following his career at the lab until 2002, Dr. Meir created over 50 violins and violas and sold most of them to professional musicians. He is a member of the Dutch group Another Jewish Voice and the Coalition of European Jews for a Just Peace. The English version of his most recent book, The End of Judaism, has just been published. He joins us now by telephone from Cape Cod, where he will be giving a talk later on today. Good morning, Dr. Hayo Meir.
Good morning, Sharif.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine.
Thank you. It was a very good text, I must say, you had.
Thank you. And thank you for agreeing to be our guest at such an early hour on a Sunday. Dr. Meir, please talk to us about your experience as a Holocaust survivor and how you were able to transcend that experience and fears to advocate for a just peace in the Middle East.
Yeah, because I so utterly agree with what you said, may I just comment by quoting two important people, I mean more important than myself. The one is Edmund Burke, a philosopher of the 17th century in England, who said, of all emotions which might cloud our judgment and and the rationality of our actions, fear is the worst. And I want to quote a tiny bit, because it so closely shows the rightness of what you say, from a book of the Jewish Israeli historian Edith Zechtal, who writes in a book, Nation and Death, with the help of Auschwitz, Israel's ultimate trump card in its relations towards the world, which time and again was defined as anti-Semitic and forever hostile, Israel immunized itself against any criticism and allowed itself a status of quasi-holiness. In this way, it closed itself off from any critical and rational dialogue with its surroundings. And she also goes on how the young people are immunized by being brought to Auschwitz, etc. But I will end the quote now.
Well, thank you. As a survivor of Auschwitz yourself, mm-hmm. you must have experienced great fear.
Yes.
And also a huge injustice, and yet you have transcended that. How did you do it?
Well, I did it by realizing that the only way of a worthy surviving, that the word survival only could get sense by staying an ethical being. And I said myself, one thing, when I survive, first of all, I do not want to survive at the cost of others. And I was very lucky, and there are many circumstances why I was very lucky and how I was very, very lucky. So I want to survive without doing injustice to others, and I never want to become so extremely dehumanized like my oppressors were. And I am afraid that the Zionists, and please, we should distinguish between Jews and Zionists, and Israel is a Zionist state and not a Jewish state. You said that, and I want to emphasize this. The characterization of Israel itself as a Jewish state is completely wrong. It's a Zionist state, and actually it's a pathological version of Zionism, which has turned ever more cruel and ever more nationalistic, ethnocentric, and xenophobic. So, and I think survival makes no sense if you are dehumanized. Then you are already dead whilst you are walking around. And you mentioned, fortunately, and I'm all with you there, that Israel's society will gradually but irreversibly be undermined by the post-traumatic stress syndromes of all the soldiers who come from reasonably ethical homes and who have to do cruelties to the Palestinians, and that will undermine society in such a way that eventually it will explode. or implode, whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
And so I realized that. I realized it makes no sense. If you dehumanize yourself, you are already dead. You may walk around, but what is life worth? I can still every morning can look into the mirror and say, "Hey, hi, how nice to see you." And that's one of the most important things you can do. And so, as I realized, I studied a lot. I mean, besides my work as a research manager in the later, or research physicist and research manager, I studied a lot. I read a lot and wrote books about what I went through. And I came to the conclusion that any suffering has no sense in itself, but by giving it a significance, by interpreting it, you can give it a significance, and that's how I did it. And there's one thing.
Yes.
Sharif.
Yes.
That is a very important one.
Yes.
Suffering you undergo, you live through, is less threatening than suffering you only have heard about. And that is why the second generation is in many cases even more traumatized than the first one. Because they have not gone through it. They do not know that it can be survived, it can be overcome in some cases. But if you only hear about it, it becomes an overwhelming fear which hardly can ever be mastered.
How true. You mentioned that Israel has immunized itself by appealing to the Holocaust and Auschwitz. But let me ask you this. Certainly, when someone bring it down to an individual level, if certain individuals have been abused and badly treated when they were children, do they have the right to kill later on and use that as a defense? I don't think that the suffering, however deep and however painful it must have been, entitles people to do the same to others.
Sharif, this is one of my fundamental principles which I time and again repeat in my talks, that no suffering on earth, whatever, how severe and how bad, ever gives people the right, any people the right, to let others suffer. And actually, it is utterly un-Jewish, because in the Old Testament it says that when it talks in Leviticus 18:19-34, it says how to deal with the foreigner. It says treat the foreigner who lives among you, you should treat like if he were born amongst you. Love thy neighbor. He is like you. That is the right, not love thy neighbor like thyself. No, he is like you. That's the right translation. Love thy neighbor. He is like you, because also you were a foreigner in Egypt. In other words, the basic book of Judaism, the Torah, says because you were treated badly, you should treat others well, and not because you were treated badly, you can treat any other human being also badly. So that is the basic principle of Judaism. Besides what, and it was is it. Empty times it is repeated by later interpreters, the rabbis like Rabbi Hillel, and I go into it very extensively in my book, and I will in a few hours I will repeat it in the talk I have to give here in Cape Cod.
Yes, on that occasion, who published your book? We'd like to get a copy of that book.
Yeah, well, look, the you know the influence of pressure on publishers, etc. And I was several times actually with a well-known publisher in England, but he didn't dare. I don't know why. I never heard why he didn't want to publish. And eventually I have an American nephew, so the son of my brother who lived in the States, he wanted to be a publisher, so he has published it under the title G. Meyer Books, and I will talk to him this afternoon. He will come here. He lives at the moment in Boston, and he has difficulty at the moment to find a distributor. But I hope he will succeed in that. But he has a website, yeah. And that is HTTP double dot two dashes and then www.gmeyerbooks in one word G of Gerald Meyer Meyer books.com. That is his website, and I think from that, in any case, as long as they are not yet in bookshops, which I hope there will be, you can order it.
Wonderful, thank you. In your experience in Europe and in the Netherlands at this point, are the official mainstream Jewish organizations in the Netherlands and in other European countries as quick to condemn any criticism of Israel as the American organizations are?
Just as quick. They are all, it's all the same. They are all under, I call them, I'm sorry to say, but I call them undercover organizations of the State of Israel. And they are completely under the spell of that. And so my organization, which, by the way, is called, in English, it's called A Different Jewish Voice. It's in Dutch, it's an under Joodskalite, but under is the same Germanic word, but it should be translated into A Different Jewish Voice, mm-hmm. because we want to differ from the mainstream Jewish organizations, and we have a relatively good influence, and it is worth noting that we erected, so our little club erected the EJJP, European Jews for Just Peace, which contains, I think, 18 organizations from 9 countries in Europe, which all want to do the same as we do. But it's not a very strong organization, but we try our best in order to show the world that there are Jews who are not Zionists and are especially who are against the cruel oppression methods practiced by Israel under the name of security.
Yeah, in this country we have an equivalent. We have a national organization called Jewish Voice for Peace.
Yes. Yes, yes.
With chapters in various states.
Yes, 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 yes.
What's your opinion of the role fear plays in getting Jews to blindly support Israel, no matter what human rights violations it may commit?
Yes, look, that is, I go into it very deeply. I actually have made, although I'm not a psychiatrist, but I have checked this with psychiatrists, and I've based it on a psychiatrist theory, which is also a German Jewish psychiatrist who went to the Netherlands. He's, I think, 12 years my senior, but he still lives, and I checked it with him. That's the theory of sequential traumatization, which says that once you have been traumatized and you get another trauma on top of it, it has worse consequences. And that is one aspect of the theory, and what I added, I said the socio-cultural heritage of Judaism, one of the most important ones, is regularly to commemorate bad things which happened to Jews in history. The prime example is the slaves in Egypt. And if you have just commemorated that in 1648 the Ukrainian Cossack Khmelnytsky murdered thousands of Jews, and a week later a niece of yours is murdered in a pizzeria in Tel Aviv, then the commemoration of that massacre hundreds of years ago hectized you as a first trauma, and so the actual fact of the murder of your niece is much and much worse. And therefore I think that many, many Jews, maybe a majority of present day living, are collectively clinically paranoid, and so that makes this fear so vivid. I don't have it, I'm sorry to say, and as I say, one of the reasons is because I managed to survive, and I saw that very, very, very threatening things can be overcome. And but I must add, I was extremely lucky because I had a craft. I had, as a refugee, I had learned to be a metal worker. So instead of being in the terrible winter of 44, 45, I could work in a factory repairing railway wagons for the Germans, and instead of being outside and freezing to death. And so without luck one cannot survive. But anyhow, I did, and I know that there are possibilities. And yeah, I every year I speak to a school in Ramallah and tell the kids there that they should, the secondary school in Ramallah, that they should learn and learn and learn, because that's the only way to overcome, to build up yourself. And try to conquer the stress and the fear.
Let me broach another subject, if I may, with you. Have you read former President Jimmy Carter's book, Israel?
No, but I've read about it, mm-hmm. and I've actually written an article on it in that I think he's even too friendly, he's too optimistic, because I understood. I think he wrote also an article in the Dutch paper. I mean, so a brief account of his work, and he talks there about, look, we must in the final stages negotiations, they can exchange, they can keep the settlement blocks, and then they give other things back, which is an illusion. First of all, final stages negotiations is one big crap illusion, because have you ever seen a mouse and an elephant together at the negotiation table? Final negotiation table between the two parties is an illusion. It can only be done under the auspices of a very, very strong third party. That's one thing. But secondly, letting them keep the settlement blocks means they've picked the best water resources, the most fertile grounds, and what they can offer as a compensation is a desert or near desert. So I think even he is too optimistic.
Well, on the subject of apartheid,
yes,
you have obviously traveled quite a bit,
yes,
in Israel and in the,
yes,
occupied territories.
Yes.
In your opinion, does apartheid, is a system of government that Israel has imposed on Palestinians in the occupied territories, is that an apartheid system?
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
How about apartheid in Israel proper?
Oh, too. But look, there's a nice pun. I don't know whether you heard it. Israel is a democratic Jewish state.
Yes.
It is democratic for Jews and Jewish for the Palestinians. So it is. Look, the unequality of rights is atrocious. And there is, you cannot, just as little as you can talk about justice, and so that you, that justice is one thing and must, is always two-sided, and so it is with democracy. You cannot have a democracy for Jews. It's a contradiction in terms, in my opinion, it's atrocious. Because what they do under, especially in the occupied country, occupied territories, by preventing young people going to schools and universities, is in my opinion near to murder. Because why did I emigrate to flee to Holland as a boy of 14 alone? Why? Because I couldn't go to a German school anymore. After November 38, Jewish kids were not allowed to go to a German school, and in the city where I lived there was no Jewish school, and other Jewish schools in Germany were all full. So I viewed the future of not getting no proper education, which to my parents and myself was a terrible existential threat. And that's why I, as a boy of 14 alone, went to Holland. And so I know what it means, it being prevented from developing yourself and getting the opportunity to make out of yourself what your potential is. And so, and that is on a great scale is prevented. That is what happens to young Palestinians, and I suffer for them.
Well, on the issue of apartheid, exploring what can be done about that, there is a growing movement,
yes,
for the boycott, divestment,
yes,
and sanctions against Israel.
Yes, yes.
Do you support such a campaign?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And look, and the European Union has a weapon which we always press, but we without success so far to use, because the Israel has, so I'm BDS is the only way, or one of the few ways which can be done, which could be done in reality. And the other one is what I say is that Israel is an associate partner in the EU, but there is a contract between an associate partner and the European Union, which says that the association requires from the associate that she applies or holds to the Fourth Convention of Geneva with respect to humanitarian law, and nor you Sharif nor I Hayo need to be convinced that they don't do that. Go against the Fourth Geneva Convention every day. So they could, the contract could be upheld, but the EU doesn't do it, and that is very, very, very bad. And in this way, I tell you one thing: the whole Western culture, the United States, who pay Israel, the EU, who pays Israel, the EU, which refrains from sticking, from making Israel stick to the convention about human rights, we all are co-guilty of the terrible crimes which happened there. And this is, and what we did lately, I know, as you know now too, and your listeners also, what it means, genocide. I was very near to it. But I think that a form of genocide where you know who is the perpetrator and the victim is one thing. A form of genocide where you induce the group which you hate to kill itself, like happened very recently in Gaza, is in a way worse. Because in that way, you even if one Palestinian kills another due to the circumstances you have created by population density and by refusing food and what have you and any aid into the area, then you do something which is worse, because once they kill each other, there is no difference anymore between perpetrators and victims, and mourning becomes nearly impossible, and that is the lowest state, and the Western culture will eventually pay the price for this.
There is much truth in this, and there's also the added fact that abuse, not only physical abuse but psychological abuse, where Palestinians are robbed of their dignity,
yes, sure,
as human beings,
yeah,
that is killing the spirit.
I know,
and it's just as it is as bad as killing the body. In fact,
yeah,
it is worse.
Yes, I know all about being robbed of your dignity, or the essay of the other to rob you of your dignity. That's one thing. But there are also one of the very bad things is that they use Palestinians who need hospital treatment. They use them as traitors. They say, "Okay, you may go if you are a spy for us," which is extremely bad. It is one of the worst things you can do, because, as I say, that is how we started. Why did you survive, and why are you still the powerful old man you are? Well, because I can look into the mirror without shame. If you have become a traitor, even for a good purpose, you can no longer do that, and that is very killing. There's the former Minister of Education of Israel, Shulamit Aloni.
I'm familiar with her and her writings.
I beg your pardon?
And the writings, she said the killing,
yes,
the murder of a population,
yeah,
under cover,
yeah, yeah,
of,
yeah,
righteousness.
Okay, we talk about the same article, yes.
Yes, yes.
Very, very important, and very, very at the point of what I went through and what I think and what I believe, yes.
Dr. Meir, if you had an opportunity to address the official mainstream Jewish organizations,
yes,
in the United States,
yeah,
what would you like to say to them?
That's what I said to you. I mean, they are the... Look, oh, I might give the talk I give to this afternoon, that I say that it's completely... that there's a vast difference. There's a canyon between Zionism and what I have understood that Judaism is. And I come from a German Jewish Reform, very liberal Jewish Reform surroundings, and we were full of the teachings of Moses Mendelssohn, the enlightened philosopher, Jewish Enlightenment philosopher of about the 1750s, and the grandfather of the composer. And in his Judaism, and especially in the Judaism his followers developed in Central Europe, and actually the Americans followed that too. In 1885 there was a platform in Pittsburgh, I think, yes, and they said the same thing. Ethics is in the center of Judaism, and I'm afraid that is not present in the Israeli behavior, and therefore it is Zionist behavior, has nothing to do with the Judaism as I and many others understand it, not enough, but still many others understand it, and it makes from Judaism a terrible caricature. It has nothing to do with Judaism, as I and many others understand it. There is no justification, and the excuse of security, or is it... is absolutely is shady, and because look, Israel is such a strong nation, and there is no need to be so over anxious there. No need whatsoever. But as you find it already with the old Greeks. I mean, aggression always breeds aggression, and. If they ever had offered at the time Arafat a real piece of Palestine and given him the opportunity to make a state of his own at the time, there would be no question of terrorism, in my opinion. And what they do, I mean, that the world takes it. That Hamas must acknowledge our right of existence. Whereas you cannot possibly—it's an impossibility—to acknowledge the right of existence of a state which refuses explicitly, like Olmert still recently affirmed, to define its borders. It's incredible, and the world. The world politicians, the Western politicians, don't protest, and Hamas is very, very, very stupid in psychological and public relations way, that they, some have eventually said it, but not loud enough and not repeatedly enough. How can we acknowledge a state which refuses to define its borders? So that means that the whole world could belong to Israel. No.
One final comment, Dr. Beyer. South Africa, one of the mainstays of South Africa's final settlement of the apartheid there, was the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. And Archbishop Tutu, who was interviewed many times by Bill Moyers, for example, gave an incredible exposition of the importance of forgiveness.
Yeah.
In the sense that when I forgive someone, mm-hmm. when someone wrongs me, does something wrong to me, he gives me the power or the right to pay back.
Yes.
But when I forgive, I willingly give up that right to revenge.
Yes.
How important, in your opinion, in this case of Israel and Palestine, is the importance of forgiveness?
Of overwhelming importance. But look, you can only forgive. Why? I was badly treated by citizens, by human beings who called themselves Germans but were Nazis. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And you could say, how come that you have nowadays so many friends? You are very often in Germany and you feel you have no difficulty being there. Well, because I have understood that it were the Nazis who did it, that the Germans were, due to the dictatorial system, had no occasion to really protest at the time. And after the war, the Germans did their utmost to repay the unrepayable by their... So don't forget that the build-up of Israel was greatly supported in the first years by the German payments Okay. So they acknowledged their guilt, the guilt. And we had a good, very good friend also, one of the first people in my organization, a different Jewish voice, a psychiatrist who had been the psychiatrist in the Israeli army for 7 years and came back absolutely so disappointed.
But we have just about a minute left.
Okay. He said, forgiveness can only start by acknowledging the responsibility of Israel towards the Palestinians. Otherwise, forgiveness is impossible. And that was what the Germans did towards me. They acknowledged their completely wrong behavior, completely wrong behavior of the Nazis who called themselves Germans.
Thank you so much, Dr. Meir. We have to leave it here. Unfortunately, I wish we could have a longer discussion. But
I would love to. I would love. But when will this be transmitted?
Oh, it is transmitted now. It has been on the air live.
Oh, this is live.
This is live. Yes.
Okay.
And we will have it posted on a website.
Ah.
And I will let you know when that is done.
Yes, please. If you post it to Hassan, here's my website. Here's my email, and so that he can email it to me.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
And thank you for your interview, and thank you for your really great insight into the matter.
Thank you very much. That's a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that does it for today. We wish our listeners a pleasant and restful weekend and look forward to having you with us next week, same time. Until then, this is Sherif Fahm signing off for now and reminding our listeners to get involved in the good fight for peace in the Middle East. Palestine is in dire need and could use all the help it can get. Thank you.